Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. How are you doing today, bud?
I'm doing great.
All right, you ready to rock and roll?
I am so ready.
We're going to shift up the show a little bit today, and you'll find out more about that in just a second. But before we get started, okay. I was thinking about something at the gym this morning. I was trying to get yoked or swole, as the kids are saying.
You're always yoked and swole.
I did find out that I'm probably the only 48-year-old guy who dances constantly at the gym. There's another lady who she's probably, and I don't want to say her age, but in her mid-50s, yeah. And this lady is rocking the dance moves. Like, she's got finger guns, she's doing air lassos, and just having a great time. And I was like, wow, that seems kind of weird. And then I found myself dancing in the mirror, mm-hmm. and I was like, yeah, I kind of like this. You know,
I could see you doing that.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and what got me thinking was an opinion. Now, I've got a definition of opinion.
Okay.
A view or judgment formed about something, not necessarily based on fact or knowledge. Now, okay. When you enter the recovery world or the world of addiction, there's a lot of opinions. And, you know, most of the time, people throw their opinions like they're facts.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know what I mean? Yep. And that what it is. But you want to go, no, this is just your opinion of what it is.
Yeah.
And the great thing about an opinion is it can be changed. It's not easily changed.
Well, that depends on how defensive a person is. But you're right. Opinions can be swayed by facts or just other people's opinions.
Like, and when I was looking through Facebook and I was scrolling through the Project Recovery Facebook page, you know, there's a lot of opinions that are presented to us as comments, but almost in the form of a fact. And until
yes.
you walk
oh,
in...
social media is full of that. Yeah.
Until you walk in someone's shoes... You know, I think you almost should keep your opinion to yourself just for a little bit until you find out the whole story. Because when I was in active addiction, there was a lot of people talking about me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On
social media, you were a popular topic.
I was a hot button.
Yeah.
And people would say things and without knowing the whole story. Now, it's not possible for everybody to know everybody's full story, but that doesn't stop people from throwing their opinions. And opinions are very detrimental when it comes to addiction and recovery. And it's from loved ones. It's from addicts themselves. And even so much as the opinion you have of yourself. Because mm-hmm. not based in much truth or knowledge. It's just an opinion.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get your take on opinions because you're a psychologist and a lot of people come in here and they talk to you and about their lives, their stories and all that stuff. And how much does an opinion play into certain things?
Into their life story?
Sure.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Well, it kind of goes back to that saying, I like to say perception determines reality. Like, your opinion is just a perception of something. It's what you believe. It's what you think. It doesn't, like the definition said, it doesn't have to be based in fact. And so a lot of people see the world just through their own opinions. And so they think they're right mm-hmm. about things all the time. And that can be annoying to others, but it can actually be detrimental to the person. You know, if the person has their opinions about addiction recovery or why a person becomes an addict or mental health issues, then we often, you know, see them, they sort of get stuck in those opinions and they can't see beyond their prejudices.
How many times have we had people in here on the podcast who had battled addiction multiple times only to come up a little bit short? And so they finally sat down and they looked in the mirror and goes, well, this is what it's going to be. And so now I'm just going to be the best addict I could ever be because yeah. that was their opinion and they couldn't have been changed. And it wasn't truth. It wasn't fact because
right.
we know recovery is possible.
Yeah.
But to them, it was the opinion of themselves that this is not going to work for them. So this is what I'm going to do. And
well, opinions are often influenced by a person's emotional state as opposed to their cognitive or logical state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to make that shift. Especially if you spent most of your life, be honest with yourself. Nobody answer. We've got a few people here in the studio. Don't answer. But just think, when I make decisions, how often is that based on my emotion about something versus the logic or the data about something?
75% of the time.
Yeah. You're an emotional thinker, right?
I really am.
Yeah, it's high. Now, you're an intuitive person,
mm-hmm.
and I think you're an optimistic person. And so a lot of times that works out for you, but a lot of times it's gotten you in some trouble, right?
Uh-huh.
And so we have people in here a lot of times where they're like, you could just see they were making emotional decisions based on opinions time after time after time. And oftentimes it took opening up their mind to another person's opinion, which might be based more on facts and data, like listening to somebody who has something to offer them before that changed their opinions and therefore what they ended up doing. But up until that point, up until we open up our mind to other people's opinions, which might be less based on emotion, we can make some pretty big mistakes.
So think about this. You got emotional decisions and logical decisions.
Right.
And now you're throwing in substances or alcohol, which will change your emotional state and your logical state.
Right.
And you're now trying to make decisions with that in the mix. I mean, you can see where it becomes this whirlwind yeah. of just chaos.
Yeah, chaos is probably the right word, yeah.
You know, and so that's what I just want to caution people, you know, with their opinions. Because a lot of people want to hear their opinions coming out of your mouth.
Oh, for sure. Well, let me give you a weird example. Like this is funny because this morning I was on a big meeting with lots of people involved at this big meeting. I'm not going to throw the meeting under the bus, but it's a University of Utah healthcare meeting. Lots of people in there, and some of the doctors that were talking were saying we wanted to start doing this particular treatment. And it's going to be great. And they were explaining why and da da da. And then another doctor came on the call and said, basically, that's your opinion. There's no data to back that up. We shouldn't be doing that, you know, and it turned into this huge eruption. And in the end, we had to admit that there just wasn't data to back up starting this new treatment. We needed more that we need data, healthcare data, because it's people's health. And it's also their money and time to come in for these treatments. But it was interesting that even in a bunch of well-educated people, emotion and opinions sometimes take over the logical brain for at least a time. Luckily, they kind of got outvoted, but until some data can back up their opinion. But it happens at all areas of our lives, even in a very important healthcare meeting.
But we can say that data is there for those in recovery, that it is possible.
It is. Oh, in general. And I will say this. So to go to the other side a little bit, not everything has to be data driven.
No.
Not everything. There are some things, and you and I have talked about, like, there are a lot of different ways up Sober Mountain. And if for some reason doing this other thing like
works for you,
you know, the prayer circles or something where there maybe not be data, but there are a lot of people who feel like that really works for me. I think there definitely is
the connection
validity in that. However, I will say that if you want to just look at is recovery possible, not just sobriety, and we'll draw that distinction. Sobriety is just not using. Okay, and we know that that's not always a great place for a person or their family.
Mm-mm.
But being in a life of recovery, being a productive, healthy, happy person, does recovery work? The answer is yes, it does. And there's plenty of data that shows that there are a lot of different options, everything from 12-step to chemical interventions to lots of things that can really improve a person's possibility or probability of being a person in recovery. So yeah, there's plenty of data to show that it works.
I remember when I was in active addiction, and this was the summer of right before I went into Pinnacle Recovery. And my dad was talking to me on the golf course, and I was drinking as I usually do. And I was drunk, you know, and my dad was talking about it being a problem and all this other stuff. And I remember telling my dad, I go, you know, a lot of people just think I'm this drunk. And my dad goes, yeah. And he goes, it's really simple. You've got two things to do. And I go, okay, I'm all ears. What do I do? He goes, you can either prove them wrong or you can prove them right. And right now you're proving them right.
Hmm.
You have a choice and you've got to figure that out. And it took an accident and me going into recovery and a lot of soul searching and figuring out who I am. But I did change a lot of people's opinions. Now, there's still people out there who have opinions that I'm still this drunk and this heathen, and that's okay because that's their opinion and they can have it, but it doesn't make it true.
Because
right. If they don't really know me, if they knew me, they would know how serious recovery is to me, how much I love to help, and what a gift recovery has been to me, my family, and I'll be forever, ever grateful.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly worked for you and your family, and we have the only, I mean, not the only, that sounded bad, but one of the main reasons I love doing this show is for that reason. Every week we get to see how it's operating in somebody's life and how wonderful their life is because they took, you know, they jumped in and did recovery. And we're going to talk about some rock bottoms today with our guests. Mm-hmm. And even though your dad gave you that insightful conversation, it took a rock bottom experience for you to realize I want to prove them wrong instead of prove them right. So sometimes knowledge isn't enough. Sometimes we have to have some experiential learning.
Yeah, I'm with you. And this week we got two guests from Wasatch Recovery, and we're going to start with their rock bottoms and what they're doing. It's Corey and Decker. You're listening to Project Recovery right here on KSL. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. Our guest today is Corey Markasich. And I nailed that.
You nailed that name. I told you to write it down, but you just went for it.
We were practicing before the mics went hot, and I was like, I'm going to mess this up.
Well, that was, it was, you could mess that up in a way we might be, you know, make us
uncomfortable.
This
is KSL, you know what I mean? Hey, but even, you know, good things happen to me every once in a while.
Every day.
Amen. Since recovery, I am blessed beyond belief. Let's talk to Corey. He's the executive director of Wasatch Recovery, right up here in Salt Lake City, Utah. Mm-hmm. But before we find out all the cool stuff you're doing for there, Corey, we want to start with your rock bottom. But before we hit the rock bottom, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and, you know, a little bit about your family.
Yeah, so I grew up actually just right over here, Bountiful, Utah. Actually, I was born in Woods Cross, but then grew up in Bountiful.
So were you Woods Cross High School or Bountiful High
Woods
School?
Cross. I went to Woods Cross High.
All right. Because that's the distinction, right? The line.
Oh, it is.
In Bountiful,
there
one or the other.
Is.
Yeah.
Rivalry is real.
So I have two kids right now, and I live right on the border of that boundary. And I have one kid that will end up at Bountiful and one daughter that will end up at Woods Cross.
Okay, well, not to go too far down this rabbit hole, but I have two grads from Woods Cross.
Yeah.
And then one graduated from Bountiful, and the other will too.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, so we'll have two
boat.
And two.
You get it. You feel it, right?
Yeah. Not really. I don't care.
Well, so part of actually kind of, and we'll kind of get into this, but part of kind of my story was that. So I grew up in Woods Cross, and I was about seventh grade. So my parents came to us and said, hey, we're moving. You know, we're going to move to this new beautiful home we're building that was in North Salt Lake. And to me, that kind of shattered me. I was like, what? This was my world. You know, we lived in this little...
Seventh grade's a hard time
to
move. Yeah.
Well, and at the time, we had this pretty cool group of friends, and we were all pretty close, you know. And it... Now, in reality, it was only like 3 miles away. But to me, it was a big deal. It was far away. It was on the other side of the freeway. We were moving, you know, to the hill. It was... It just felt weird to me. And I thought I was going to lose all my friends and everything. And, you know, you get to seventh grade and it's weird anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get there and it's
puberty.
Yeah, puberty. And you think you're an adult and you think you've got it figured out, but you're still just a little teeny kid. I've got a seventh grader right now and I'm watching her go through it. And I'm like, oh man, here we go.
Yep.
You know, so that was kind of where my journey started, actually. It's, you know, I was trying to figure out who you are and what you do. And I just kind of had some really, really good friends. We had a close group of friends. And as things progressed and we went on, we just started kind of getting into smoking pot a little bit, drinking, you know, here and there. Nothing too bad, though. You know,
yeah.
It was just goofing off, dumb kids, like, oh, you know, I stole a beer. Let's all split it between 10 of us, you know. Nothing too crazy. And then high school, got into high school, and that kind of progressed. You know, we had... again, a pretty close group of friends.
But, you know, you say it kind of progressed, but that's the natural progression of alcohol and weed and substances.
Absolutely.
It does progress. I mean, when people talk about gateway drugs, now I'm not going to get in the argument about weed or whatever it is being a gateway drug, but all drugs are gateway drugs because this makes you feel good. I wonder what this one does. And then you start sampling and trying, and then you find the one that is your jam or your DOC, if you will.
And it makes you feel good. Cool, right? Like we thought we were being adults and we were doing something crazy. I was at the time, you know, my goal in life at the time was I was going to be a professional snowboarder. That was it, you know. I was going to do it. And I was, and some of my friends actually even made it, like did some pretty good things with it. And that was it, you know. So we were kind of in this scene of crazy kids just doing stupid stuff, you know, and that came along with it. We hung out with a lot of older kids in high school, and so that naturally came on. And you know, what was weird at the time with me, I never loved it, you know, like it, I would do it here and there, but it never grabbed me. Like I just, all my friends would talk about, you know, oh, it's so fun to be high. And it actually made me kind of anxious. And so I just never loved it, you know, but I would be with them. It was my friends and we would go to parties. I'd nurse the same beer, you know, all night and just be part of it, but not ever, you know, kind of get to that point. I didn't like that feeling. However, you know, I got introduced to some pain meds and I can never even remember if it was an actual injury or whatever happened. Cause we were always hurt and all, you know, I don't think they were actually mine in the beginning. It was kind of a friend, hey, you know, your knee hurts, here you go. And I remember taking a couple of those and feeling good or feel, you know, not like totally high, but I just remember feeling kind of warm, you know, just that kind of, I feel good. Now working in the field for all these years and doing this, I understand what that was and what was going on. And
what was?
Well, for me at the time, I didn't realize this. I had a lot of anxiety, you know. I was dealing with a lot of stuff. You're a kid, you know, there's a lot of anxiety, had a lot of uneasiness, you know, and that was, it was kind of, pain meds, as we know, don't just kill pain, physical pain. You know, they do a lot of emotional pain too.
Well, I think that's when people come on here and they talk about taking that opioid for the first time. And their eyes kind of, yeah. And they're like, oh, that euphoric. Was my thing, that euphoria. It's much more the psychological and the emotional.
Yeah.
In fact, I think an argument can be made for opioids that they're less effective at actual pain management than they are at emotional management.
Well, that's the work in the field. We know that, right? Yeah. People come in and they're like, I've got all this back pain and all this stuff. And they're taking all these pain meds and we get them off of it and their pain goes away. You know,
yeah,
it's just how it works. So, yeah, so that was about junior year. And then it was funny because my friends that would get hurt, that I became kind of the person that, hey, you know, Corey likes pain meds. You know, if you blow your knee out, I don't like these. They make me itch. Give them to Corey.
What
he
do we
loves
know
them.
About Corey? Oh, he likes pain meds. Yeah. We'll get him those for
he
his
likes
birthday.
Pain meds. Well, yeah. And I was this kind of self-righteous kind of jerk where I would make fun of my friends, like, dude, you shouldn't drink, you shouldn't smoke pot, that's stupid, you know, that's not going to make you a good person, when I'm taking, you know, pain meds, and you know, it was
like Tic Tacs,
yeah, like, and they would do their own thing and I'd do my own thing.
Was a little bit of that because of the legal versus illegal nature of those things?
It was that and religious, you know. I grew up very, very religious and LDS. Not like this strict. My parents were very good. You know, they weren't like, you're going to church or else. I mean, they let us choose and they let us and did a very good job of teaching us what was right. And so I had that. Like, it was a value of mine that, you know, that is...
Choose the right, do the right,
the right
thing.
Right,
you know?
And mm-hmm. But I've justified in my head that, hey, on that list, it doesn't say Lortab.
It does not.
And so
drugs this was prescribed by a doctor.
Right,
well,
right.
And that's what I think it's not. It's definitely part of the LDS church culture, but I think it's just kind of a general sure. U.S. culture that if it's prescribed by a doctor, okay. It seems more legitimate. It seems more safe. And if you're buying it on a back street somewhere or going to some scrubby house to get it, then there's something taboo about yep. that. So we easily, I mean, the addict brain always wants to justify and rationalize, right? And so that's, I figured that even at a young age, that's why you were scolding your buddies
absolutely.
Who were smoking weed and rolling joints in the snow
yeah.
parking lot, you know, but yeah.
And I was definitely part of that, but it was funny how I made it okay. I remember even I ended up getting my wisdom teeth out at some time. So I got a prescription of my own. And then I kept that bottle for, you know, probably a year or two. And then I would get other pills and put them in it because that even made it more okay. Right.
You know, I actually have a bottle.
I have a bottle.
Yes.
It's mine.
Yeah, I can show people with my name on it.
It's worn out.
The dates and the names are all worn out. But
yeah.
Yeah.
So that it was crazy, you know, and it again as teenagers and we there were some of us that kind of got a little bit worse than others, but at the time it was never too bad of kind of on this scale, you know. And then high school was coming to an end, and I actually had a really good friend that had graduated a couple years before. He was a senior when I was a sophomore. He had moved on and gone to college, and he was home for Memorial Day weekend. And I didn't know at the time, you know, we lived in the bubble of Bountiful and we were all just happy and everything's great and we think everything's just hunky-dory. And he had been struggling with a lot of stuff, you know, just some depression, a lot of things that none of us even knew. And he ended up taking his life. And that was my last week of high school. And so we had like our graduation and a funeral on the same day.
Oh.
And it was pretty rough, you know. Yeah. And I remember at the time, you know, us as kids kind of huddled over here, like trying to figure out, you know, what's this world about, right? You know,
right.
And parents over here worried, you know, about their kids and what's happening. And none of us were really talking, you know, like it was kind of these two different pods. And again, now working in the field and knowing, you know, I mean, all of us, we needed to talk. We had to get that stuff out. And a lot of us at the time just either stuffed it, you know, just kind of, okay, that's, I guess this is life, you know, we got to figure this out. So a lot of us at the time, you know, some of us went on missions, some of us went to college, we all kind of fractured at the time. It was the end of school anyway. Right. And so everyone went their own separate ways and kind of did their own things. And some people struggled, you know, some people still are struggling. It's pretty sad.
So where does your rock bottom come into play? Fast forward how many years?
So let's fast forward about, that was 18, fast forward to about, let's say 5 years or so ahead. So what happened is I progressively got, you know, more into pills. I actually stopped like drinking and smoking, all that stuff. Like I was like done, you know, that scared me, you know, that was a weird thing. I didn't do anything for probably a year or two. You know, I went to school. I was kind of just doing some things. Got into college, met a really cool girl, and my life was really good. You know, I was pretty busy and doing some good things. Every once in a while, pain meds would creep in, but it wasn't like it was before. I even friends kind of just went a different way. I was working and got pretty busy. But fast forward some years later, you know, and it was during this OxyContin boom. You know, thing everyone was doing OxyContin. And I had a friend, well, some friends, you know, they, you know, were kind of doing it here and there. And someone said, hey, you should, you know, try this. I know you like pain meds back in the day. Try this. It's like pain med, but it's super small. You only have to take a little bit of it and you don't have to take all these, you know? And I'm like, what the heck? You know, whatever. Let's give it a shot. And I remember the very next day after that thinking, wow, that was awesome. You know? And up until then I had never bought pills. I didn't know you could do that. I thought it was just, you get it from a doctor, you know, it was legal. And so that put me on a progression for the next couple of years of just, I found out where to buy them. The way my mind works is, you know, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it, you know? So I weaseled my way into who was getting them and where they're getting them and what's going on. And I just didn't want to buy one and two here and there. I wanted to have a bunch. And that's where this kind of got crazy is I found some people that were actually getting it from doctors and they were going in and saying, hey, you know, I got back pain or whatever it was. And they'd get, you know, these scripts that were illegal. And I didn't know it at the time. I was pretty naive to what was going on, but I didn't know it at the time, but even the doctor was in on it, you know, and I had never gone to the doctor personally, but I would buy it from the people that would go to the doctor.
And that was a big thing back then.
Yeah.
You know, that's, we have different type of oversight now for all of that, but you're absolutely right. Some of these, you know, physicians, and I use that term lightly because a physician's supposed to take care of people. You know, they became drug dealers, you know, they knew for sure what they were doing was wrong. But other people, I think, were a little bit in the dark because you're like, well, I have a prescription.
Yeah.
So I think that as it filtered down to non-medical people, you know, I'm not giving anybody a full pass, but I think a lot of people were like, well, we got the prescription. How illegal could this be? Well, it was very illegal.
And that's what happened is all of a sudden. So I had got married. I was almost done with college. I was up at the University of Utah. I was studying finance. I had about like a semester left, and then the summer left. And I was pretty deep into it. I mean, I was using it every day. I was bad. I tried several times to stop. I even told my parents, told my wife, like they knew what was going on, but we didn't know what to do. I just thought I just got to stop, you know? And it was weird because I had isolated myself from other people. I wasn't like going with friends and it wasn't this huge party thing. It was me internally. And again, it was more of the emotional stuff, right? I mean, that creates more anxiety. So I was just a mess, right? And I had gone to a doctor. Someone said, hey, you should go to a doctor. They've got this new thing called Suboxone that can help you out. So I go to this doctor and I start going to him for a month. And of course that doesn't work. You know, I'm just a mess. And one day I go to him and it's early in the morning. I had a day off of work. I was working at Fidelity Investments and I had a day off of work. And
managing lots of millions of dollars.
Well, high as a kite. What's funny, I look back on it now and I had more responsibility than I should have, you know.
I don't mean to call you out, but like that's what happens. Like, you know, like we have these jobs where we're responsible for other people in some way. In this case, it's money. And, you know, when a person's in their addiction, they're not capable of doing a good job. But anyway, go ahead. So you go in, it's early morning, you go into the doctor, you got a day off, and
he gives me my script. I go home and I get a knock on the door. It's like 7:30 in the morning. And I'm like, who the heck's knocking on my door?
Mormons.
Yeah, right. Missionaries. Missionaries or cops, one or the other. Yeah.
Either way, don't answer it.
So I walk to the side, and I walk over, and there had some drapes, and I push them over to the side. And there's these two guys down there, not missionaries. They did not have tags on.
But they were wearing suits.
They were in plain clothes.
Uh-huh.
But I had this, and I had... Up to that point, I'm in active addiction, so I'm doing dumb things. You know, there could be a million things that I could be in trouble for, but I didn't know what.
Right? Sure.
I just knew, that's not good. Something's not good. And I had this overwhelming kind of just, I'm in trouble, you know, and I need help. And I literally fell to my knees and just said, I don't know what's going on. I need some help. I'm in trouble, you know, like, and I stood up. Opened the door. They said, hey, are you Corey Markovic? Yep, I am. Place your hands behind your back, blah, blah, blah. You're under arrest. And I'm like, I've never been in trouble in my life, you know? And they proceed to arrest me. And next thing I know, I'm driving down this road in the back of a car. And they're asking me all these questions about, you know, about pills. And as they're asking me, I'm realizing they know me, you know? They know me. They know where I was yesterday. And I'm going, so I just shut up. You know, I'm just like, I don't know what's going on. I'm terrified. Take me to jail. I call my parents. By the way, my wife was home at the time, and that was not a good situation either.
Can't imagine.
That's another story. I had been lying to her and telling her everything's fine. Clearly it wasn't, you know. And they take me to jail. I call my dad and he ends up bailing me out. He's out of town though. My parents are out of town. They said, get to my house. We'll be there by tonight. So I get there back to their home. I'm home alone. You know, everything is falling apart around me and I'm a mess, you know, like I don't even know what's going on. I'm having all these weird thoughts and it's over and I need some help. And they come in, they actually probably came in at a good time because I was on that mode of, I'm going out. You know, this is a done. I got to figure something out. I don't know what it was.
Suicidal
or back to get more drugs?
Back to get more drugs. Okay. But also probably along that line. You know, like I didn't really know, again, at that time what I was doing. I was just, I got to get away.
Yeah.
You know? And luckily they showed up. So I'll give you the quick version now of all this. What happened is I was involved with as buying some pills of all these guys that were going to doctors. There was over 200 people involved. It got pretty deep. I actually have a graphic of this kind of chain of where it all went down and where I'm at on the chart. You know, I'm clear over here, but had doctors and
the pyramid of drug dealing.
And it was crazy. Yeah. It started with a doctor and a pharmacist at the top.
It was madness.
So the crazy part in all this story is I had a brother-in-law that worked for the state at the time in the insurance fraud division. And I knew he had worked in law enforcement and stuff. Didn't really know what he did to the details, of course, because I wanted to stay away because I was not doing good things anyway, right? Well, come to find out, he was like one of the lead people on this case. And what had happened is at one random time, they were with somebody doing a controlled buy or whatever, and I walk up and buy from this guy, and my brother-in-law is the one watching, right?
No.
And this was months before any of this happened, right? So I'm going to family parties, I'm doing all this stuff, and he knows.
And he knows.
Which...
One more reason not to like a brother-in-law.
Oh, yeah. And I was a piece of crap, you know? I wasn't a good guy anyway. And so it gave him more fuel than I liked me, you know? And I was young, I was a punk, I was dumb, you know? And so, that just, you know, there's a personal tie. So yeah. as I'm going to court and as I'm going through all this stuff, it just kept getting worse. I mean, more charges, more things. It was horrible. Now, when all this happened, clearly I needed to do something. I needed to get some help, right? I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what treatment was. I didn't know what counseling was. I just knew I had a problem and everyone hated me. And you know, I was like the poor me victim. Everyone hates me. I just, you know, really, I got myself into this. I got to figure this out. So luckily I had insurance at the time. And we had this really cool EAP thing at Fidelity. And they lined me up with this really cool place called Dayspring that was up at LDS. It was actually out in Taylorsville at the time. Now it's up at the hospital. But it was a day treatment program. And I went there and I loved it. Like all of a sudden I was talking about things. I was doing things. And I remember thinking, is this for real? Like, you know, like I love this stuff. And I remember thinking at night going, it took me to get to this point. I could just talk to people. Like I could work all this stuff out, you know? And I loved it so much. I was eating it up. I was there about a week and a half. And then I saw some people coming in for IOP. I didn't know what that was. And I'm like, what do those guys do? Why are they here at night? And they said, oh, it's IOP. They come in the evening. I'm like, can I do that? They're like, well, yeah, you do it after.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I have nothing to do. I've been kicked out of my home. I live in my mom's basement right now. I got a leave of absence from work, which was cool. So I was in a spot, and they're like, I don't know, I guess if you want to. So I would go in the morning and be there all day, walk over in the night, get McDonald's for dinner, and then I'd do their IOP.
You're a super student.
Dude, I had nothing to do, and I was eating it up, you know. And
so did you graduate from this program?
I did.
And was that your sober date?
I graduated, yeah. So I just got 17 years back in February, actually.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Congrats.
Yeah, so it's been a minute. Now, there's other details in there, but the one that I really want to hit on is my wife, okay? So...
Wait, I want to have you save that because I want people to come back at the very end to hear about your wife. You're listening to Project Recovery. We've got two stories, one podcast. Stick around. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. We just heard from our guest, Corey. Yep. We're going to find out what he's doing in a little later on in the podcast. But now we're going to switch gears because we've got Ryan Decker here, but we just call him Decker.
Yep.
And Decker, you are a marketer for Wasatch Recovery.
Correct.
For those who don't know, a marketer, I've had the job. I did it for Pinnacle Recovery. What is a marketer charged with?
Pretty much everything. You're in the trenches, everything from building relationships to helping people getting in to giving them hope. I mean, really, it's a very wide, I don't even know why they call it marketing, really.
But really, because I know from experience, you are the first point of contact for a lot of people when contemplating recovery.
Correct. Yeah, it is the first call and building that trust and letting them know there's hope that like, hey, you can do this. And that's where been there, done that really is crucial, uh-huh. Right? Because I'm like, look, you know, because most time people look at me and are like, no way. I'm like, for real, let me show you some pictures. Like, I've been there, done that, got the t-shirt, never want to go back, and if I can do it, you can do it.
Do you ever have to Google yourself to look at the mugshot?
No, because I got that stuff expunged, and
I can do that?
I hope it's off.
Oh, because I still Google myself.
I think
myself.
You're putting yours on your driver's license.
Yeah, I'll put it on my ATM card.
We should make a t-shirt.
Yeah, right? I'm in. Don't be a Casey.
Yeah.
So where did the story of Decker begin?
Okay, so I'll just kind of... I'll start at the beginning and just kind of skip through all the crap. But yeah, typical LDS family in Orem, Utah, mm-hmm. Utah County kid, God's country. And, you know, my mom made my, you know, our family was, you know, very normal, you know. And one day, you know, my dad and I were out pulling weeds. My mom came down the drive and She had said, you know, get inside the house. There's a big argument. My dad went up the canyon, took his life.
Oh.
So that's kind of really
How old were you at that time?
I was 7, getting ready to be 8.
Wow.
So, you know, I remember it like it was yesterday. But, you know, being a guy, you know, push that way down like it didn't happen. Try to pretend like it didn't happen. And, you know, that comes into play later on in life. But, yeah, it was not normal. You know, back in the 80s, suicide wasn't that common. I mean, it was in the paper, you know what I mean? Now it's so common. I mean, how messed up is that? That's the world we're living in. But back then it wasn't that common. But what's kind of crazy is it ran in the family. You know, my dad was from California where, you know, you only have one or two kids. And so my bloodline was wiped out with addiction and suicide pretty quick. In fact, when I turned 34, I became the oldest living male on that side of the family to make it to 34.
Wow. Wow. And that's all due to
And there's a lot of alcoholism, a lot of alcoholism and pills and things like that. And I mean,
mental health issues.
Yeah. And we didn't have what we have now. Like those resources really weren't there.
Well, back then, you're right. It was swept under the rug. People didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was just like, oh, yeah, we lost uncle or we lost, you know, but yeah.
But nobody knew why they passed away.
You just deal with it. And being a guy, like, you know, just go to work and just keep doing what you got to do. Figure it out. But, yeah, so, I mean, up until that point, my life was, you know, really good. And my mom, bless her heart, she remarried fairly quickly. I had, you know, two other siblings from my dad, and we went about it. I mean, my mom would always tell me every day, you can never try drugs or alcohol, like ever. And it was like constant. I'm like, okay, mom, okay. It was so repetitive. And then, you know, I did good. But, you know, a lot of the friends that – I got real quiet in school, right? I mean, I was dealing with a lot. And a lot of the friends that I started, you know, collecting were people from, you know, dysfunctional families, you know, addiction, things like that. And there was no judgment, and we were all equals, and we were tight. But later on in life, getting into junior high, there's only one, you know, only one way to go. And so they would start doing it, and I was, man, I'd white knuckle. I'm like, no, you know, I'm at church on Sunday. No, that's bad. Mom says, don't, you know, don't do it. And, you know, they talk about gateway drugs. I mean, my gateway drug was the first time I had a Newport cigarette, right? Because eventually, I mean, what had happened is I had finally made the decision, like, F it. I'm going to try it. And then that steamrolled into everything. This does this. What does this do? This does that. And thank heavens that back then it was just psychedelics and not like all the hard stuff that's out now, or I'd be dead for sure. But, you know, Corey and I have very similar stories, right? Which I'm sure a lot of people that come in here with opiate addiction, it's fairly similar how it starts. But yeah, I mean, I from that point forward, I was pretty much using a substance. I mean, I'm talking, I was going into my ninth grade year that summer. And then when I get into high school, I just quit caring about school. And anyway, I was only going to school to kind of party and the social stuff. And, you know, and I was, you know, doing everything under the sun. And it was like an everyday thing, you know, in the door of high school and out the back door up the canyon to get, you know, trashed. And it started out as a social thing, right? Like most people do. You know, it's a cool thing to do. We're different, the bad boys. But with that came a whole bunch of drama and jail and, you know, all that crap.
Tickets.
That
could,
yeah,
tickets. Trust issues.
Yeah.
All of it.
And that rebellious stage, I mean, I had long, believe it or not, long, beautiful hair.
Yeah.
And I had the hoops.
He's bald as the day is long now.
Yeah. I had the hoops in, you know, from JMR, wherever it was, and the Jenko jeans.
Wide leg jeans.
You know, I could fit a Geo Metro in those, man. But,
rocking the Stussy hat.
Oh, man. I tell you what, ladies loved it. But, yeah. So anyhow, that was it. I was struggling to even, you know, pass school. I mean, nowadays, if I was in school, no way I could have done it. Back then, it was old school. And you know, so I manipulate girls, put me on the roll and slip out the back and get people to do my homework. And finally, getting towards my junior year, I met a girl in seminary. For you guys don't know, that's a church class, an LDS church class. And there's this cheerleader there. And, you know, I started throwing out some one-liners and she bit. We ended up getting married out of high school. And, you know, what was crazy, she saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, right? I'm like, what the heck? Like, you know, I'm like, you're way out of my league. Like, this girl's going to wake up and realize that I'm a piece
of crap.
It
was the hair and the hoops.
That's true. Yeah. That's, I didn't think of that.
She needed a place to park her Geo.
I was pretty easy on the eyes. So we actually, buddies started getting in deep into stuff. And I actually proposed to her out of high school. And, we got married. And, that's where the minimizing and the hiding and the, now I'm realizing that there's a serious problem because I'm not just doing it socially. I'm doing it on my own. Like, and I'm not even doing it
to have fun.
Yeah. I'm stuck in like this, let's not get sick. I mean, I functioned, if you will.
So at this point, is your jam pills?
Yeah. So at the time, it's just weed and alcohol. Right?
Okay.
Weed and alcohol, and then cocaine has started coming in, right? But who can afford that, right? So that was more like a weekend thing. But it was really anything and everything up until the opiates, right? It wasn't, I really didn't care what it was.
It sounds like a lot of addicts. You had a sort of a curiosity about it and an obsessiveness about it. Just the way you describe that, you're like, well, what does this do? What does this do? What does this do? Right. And I think that's sort of a personality trait amongst many addicts where it's like we wish that curious mind would get turned on when you were in physics class and it doesn't.
Yeah.
But then the after-school chemistry class you're running with your buddies out of the back of someone's car, all of a sudden that curious mind comes on and you're like, well, what does this do? What does this do? What does this do?
What if I add this with this?
And you kind of get obsessive, yeah. And it's an academic interest, to be honest with you. It's just focused on this the drugs.
I call it research now in the industry. I mean, it's just research I had to do to get to know about what each thing does. But yeah, it was crazy, but I minimized it. I hit as good as I could to my wife. I got a job, Park Sea Ski Resort, and for people that don't know, in the ski industry, it's kind
nobody
of a culture.
Does drugs up there.
Yeah, it's like the worst place ever. Yeah. I went in with an associates and came out with a PhD, on drugs and alcohol and things, and and I did that through the Olympics and, multiple drunk tank visits, to the beautiful Summit County Jail.
Been there.
Yeah. It's cold. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of where it was going. So me and my wife clearly weren't doing well. I'd had a son in there and then I'd had a daughter, and it was just a constant struggle. And so finally, I realized, I got to figure this out. Because even though I'm somewhat successful now, I left Park City, took another job, and I was somewhat successful, bought a house, I had the cars and, things like that. And I had this beautiful family going to church on Sundays. I had all this, and it was these two different lives I was living, right? But, I figured, people started mentioning things like, you should probably look into that. That's not normal to, drink by yourself, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. What I mean? Like, it's legal to drink, right? And so a guy that actually used to own a treatment center was in my ward, and he kind of told me about AA. And I'm like, okay. And I started really kind of buying into what he was saying, and I did it. And I white-knuckled it. I don't know how I did it, but I did it. And I was clean for a couple of years, had a third child, and things were good. Like, things were working out like awesome. I mean, I was making good money, hated the job, but making good money, and I loved the people I was working with. And, everything was good. And obviously, as we all know, that never really.
It's always good until it isn't.
Yeah. And so like Corey's story, I had a little injury at work right during the height of the OxyContin phase. And that was it. So all this time I've been trying all these drugs. I'd really never tried opiates. And when I found that, it was like, ding, this is it. Oh, and it's prescribed? Like, I could still, that was it. And I was going hard. I mean, I was winning Oscars in doctors, offices. I was like, I'm dying, turn on the faucets. And they would, keep giving me more and more and more. But as most people know, I was running out of pills within, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So now I'm having to buy them on the street, but I can't spend this because it was the most lucrative, most expensive drug out there, and I couldn't.
At one point, like $80 a pill,
yeah,
right?
$80 a pill. And I didn't want my family, clearly I was still hiding it from my wife. She knew I was on this prescribed stuff, but she didn't know how bad it was. So I actually started a separate business to where I was working my guts out 24/7 just to kind of fuel this addiction, buying them on the streets. And you know, things, believe it or not, I functioned like that for over a decade on opiates. And, you know, I had a lot of people will kind of like nod off, right? I don't know if it's a chemical imbalance in my DNA from my family or from my dad's side or what. But, you know, I was always that guy that, you know, everybody started drinking, throw the cap over the shoulder. Everybody else has passed out. I'm still drinking or I'm still, you know, I just something clearly wasn't right.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I did it. I functioned. I was very successful, did all the things, had all the things, beautiful family.
But eventually that's going to come to a crash.
Yeah. And what's crazy is finally, the same guy that introduced me to AA, one morning I'm sitting in the pharmacy at like 8:30, doesn't open till 9:00. And he walks in. He says, you know, the guys who were sitting here at, you know, before the pharmacy opens on day 30 are usually the guys that need to be in a program like mine. And I'm like, whatever, you know, of course. And then I'm like, he's probably got a point. You know what I mean? Like, I should probably stop this. This is costing me so much money. I mean, a $400 a day habit, right? Because my tolerance was so high.
$400 a day.
See, I don't know how.
That's $2,800 a week.
Well, you start talking about, you know, a decade, right? Tolerance levels.
Yeah.
Right. It's that's why most people go to heroin, right? Because it's cheaper. But I didn't want to do that. The H word's the devil and, you know, devil itself, right? And, you know, this guy says this and I'm like, okay, I'll try to stop. And I'll never forget it. I was sitting on the bed and me and my wife were in an argument and she kind of left with the kids and I was so sick. I mean, opiate sickness is no joke. Death seems like a better option.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, I'm like, you know, I'm going to rob a pharmacy. I couldn't get anything. And I was just sweating bullets. And I'm like, I'm just going to end this. You know, I'm like, I'm not good to anybody. You know, I was in that poor me, how to get to this point mode. And I remember a guy mentioning heroin. And I did. I made the call and, you know, and I did it. And, you know, it kept me from getting sick. And then I learned very quickly that the people that are associated with that is not the people you want to be associated with. I mean, it's crazy. And, you know, here I am, you know, fairly successful. And I'm like, okay, I got to stop. And so I actually went and talked to a doctor. Somebody mentioned like Corey's story about Suboxone. And I went and talked to this doctor. He got me on. I'm like, I'm good. And I did it for it's probably about 2 years. And then one day I just went in there to get my prescription filled and apparently I was shaking or something along those lines. And he says, oh, you got anxiety? And I'm like, I know what that word means. I'm like, yes, I do. And he prescribed me a fairly high dose of Xanax. And that's getting into my rock bottom. I took that. I really didn't like it, right? But it made me feel different. But then I got stuck in it and now I'm snorting everything. And I'm like, so sick, like my lights on, nobody's home. And my whole world, the moment I started that, just started crashing. Everybody knew it. I couldn't hide any longer. Every single person that saw me knew something was wrong. I would quit eating and, you know, just to make it more potent in my body. And I mean, I was sick. Ended up getting a DUI with my prescription in my car on my way to work. I'm like, holy crap. My work's like, dude, go figure your shiz out. You take 30 days. And they were awesome. I love those people I work with. They were willing to do whatever. And I did. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to stop. Yeah, don't tell a narcissist I can't do something.
Yeah.
Right? And I didn't know the risks that were attached with just stopping. And so I just stopped cold turkey. I was coaching my son's baseball team. And one day I said, hey, let's go to Walmart. I'll buy you guys a video game. And I'm going to go get some stuff for dinner. And next thing I know is I've got an eye socket full of blood. I'm staring up at the ceiling. I got like 40 Walmarties staring down at me. I've got the paramedics there. My wife was sitting there, which she didn't come with me. And I'm like,
man,
I'm like, what the heck just happened? Well, I'd had a grand mal seizure on the floor.
Whoa.
And, you know, paramedics and I was like 14 minutes. And
oh,
so,
wow. So, that's a long,
yeah. So they took me in an ambulance and I still didn't associate it with the benzos, the Xanax. So I just I just kept not using them. And then, you know, I'm down sleeping with my son because my wife's still pretty upset at me. And boom, another one right in front of my son. Paramedics come back over. And then I had the magic three that makes it, you know, where you have to go have a neurologist sign off so you can keep your driver's license. I could never become a pilot. All sorts of fun consequences that came with that deal. But, I mean, nights in jail, you know, from benzos. And, like, legitimately, I finally came to a point where, okay, like, physically, I can't do this on my own.
Yeah, like, people say it's sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Like, I'm like, and I thought, like, I could do anything. Like, you know what I mean? I was a narcissist. Like, don't tell me I can't do anything. And when I'm like, this is going to kill me. And on finally the third ER visit, they're like, have you ever taken benzos? Because they were out of my system. So drug test results were showing negative, right? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, that's what it is, right? And so I checked myself into a detox. Well, my family checked me into a detox. I was there for 9 days. Went in a wheelchair because, you know, seizures are so violent that your muscles, it's almost like they just don't work. Right. And so I went to detox and I thought it was just the physical stuff. I just need not to be dependent on this crap. And so I went there for 9 days, got out, no aftercare plan. And I just white knuckled it. I was staying at my mom's house because things clearly weren't good with me and my wife. And, you know, then I'm drinking, right? Because drink is not my DOC. So I can drink. I just can't do all the hard stuff. And one day I, you know, reached up there and felt a little jingle, pill bottle. And I'm like, poor me. Took one, turned into 10, turned into a fifth of vodka, and got myself up to the University of Utah to do it again. And that's where the journey really began, the mental journey. And all the treatment centers came and talked to me. And, you know, I never heard about any of these, right? I mean, I'm still foggy. And they'd all come and talk to me. And Wasatch Recovery, Mark, the owner of Wasatch, came and talked to me. I told him, no, dude, Wasatch, what a dumb name. You know what I mean? And then all the fancy ones are these young kids called Bougie, right, where all the celebrities go. They came and, you know, a few of those came and talked to me. I'm like, okay, let's do it, right? If this is going to help me get my family back, let's do it. And I told him yes. And Mark, the owner of Wasatch, came back the next day and called whatever you want to call it. But I like to – my higher power is like –
this your cat.
This is what you need to do. And I'm like, I don't know what this is, but.
But I want to go hang out with the celebrities at the Bougie one.
I really did. But I'm like, whatever. And obviously now, you know, where I'm at now, I totally know that was my higher powers, like, hand in all this. But yeah, I went to Wasatch to start my journey and I told them I'd do 30 days. And, you know, I just told them what they wanted to hear to get the heck out of there. Sorry. And at 30 days, they said, you're still not ready. And then it turned into, you know, them saying, just give us another day. Turned into 45 days, I'm out of here. They're like, dude, you haven't surrendered. I'm like, what does that word even mean? What's surrender? And finally, around 60, I started working. I started talking about my dad and some of the trauma stuff. Because for guys, we stuff that down.
We don't
want to think about that.
Uh-uh.
And I started talking about it. And I actually started doing work. And I started actually doing this for myself and not just to save my family. And that's when I really started absorbing stuff. And a guy that you guys have had on the podcast, Todd Sylvester, one of the greatest humans I've ever met.
Amazing.
Started teaching me about, you know, their belief systems that were broken, BS, and that happiness can be a choice. And it all seemed so stupid. It seemed so stupid when he said that. Like, you saying, so if I believe this putt's going to go in, it's going to go in. He says, no, not like that. But really, I really bought into what he was doing. And thus far, it's worked. And, you know, I have 8 years in December, but it wasn't an easy journey. And it's not like once you get out of treatment, like everything's hunky-dory, right? Like you burnt some bridges. The only way you're going to rebuild those is by time. How many times have we said we're not going to do it? They have every right not to trust us. You know what I mean? And so even to this day, you know, people kind of give you the
side eye.
You high?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you really doing good?
Yeah.
And you know what? They deserve that
breathe
right.
Breathe on me.
Yeah, they deserve that right. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
But, and you know, I ended up, you know, quit, you know, changing careers and realizing how cool is it? These guys get paid to help people. And one thing I got is a PhD in drugs and alcohol. And so they wouldn't give me a job for about a year, but I got into the industry. One of the detoxes, you know, they want a year clean time, which is the standard.
Understandable.
And the detox I actually went into the first time, gave me a chance. And from there, you know, I made my way back home and now I get to help people, and it's, you know, it's, this job isn't something you do for the money. It's legitimately the most gratifying job ever, but it's heavy. You know, I mean, it's hard.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's, you're seeing people on their worst day every day.
Every day.
And helping them out. And that's what, I mean, that's what I love about this, is showing people that recovery is possible. And with your two stories, I mean, I think it's a great example that recovery is possible, and that a wonderful place Wasatch Recovery can be. Before we take a break, I've got to ask, are you back in the house with your wife?
I am. Mm-hmm. Yep, I am. Yep, and I've got, my kids are all, got, yeah, I mean, they're playing baseball, and I've got my kids here. I've got another kid going to college, and that emotional connection, right? A lot of people talk about, yeah, physically I was there for all that stuff, mm-hmm. but the emotional connection that's there, it's freaking awesome. It's beautiful.
There's, man, nothing better.
Nothing.
We're going to find out what cool things Wasatch Recovery is up to. You're listening to Project Recovery right here on KSL. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. We've got our two guests on the mic now. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. We've got Corey and Decker here. So, Corey, before we took a break to go over to Decker, you said you wanted to tell us something.
Yeah.
What was that?
I just wanted to update, and it was kind of the same thing that Ryan was just talked about. So he said how he just made it back to his house, mm-hmm. which is good. I was in the same boat. My wife actually was a huge part of my recovery. She, at the time, held a boundary. This is stuff I've learned now, you know, working in the field and going to treatment. And I don't think she knew it either, but she just had some good boundary, and she held it. I mean, she would not talk to me. She was like, hey, you know, you got to fix yourself. You got to figure this out. You hurt me. You lied. You did all these things. And I had kind of put everything back together with different family and friends. Work, I actually resigned from my job, got a different job, did a whole bunch of things, kind of had things, you know, going. And she still held strong, you know, and it was funny because to me, I was like, hey, this is my last piece, you know, and in the back of my head, I was even thinking, hey, I've got everything else okay, you know, like this is good. And dangerously starting to figure things out, like I've got everyone good, right? You know, things are good. It'd been, you know, some months, almost a year, you know, things had kind of gone on, and everything was getting cleaned up with the legal stuff. Things were moving forward, and I was, you know, back in school. I was almost done, and in the beginning of all this, she actually had served me with divorce papers, and it broke my heart, you know, because she was my person, and I wouldn't sign them. I'm like, no, you know, and I'm not going to do this. And finally, of course, I had to. You know, had to sign them and gave them to her and had them get them notarized. And it was awful.
Oh, yeah.
It was that stung. And even after I did that, I thought she'll talk to me now, but she wouldn't. She just kept holding strong. She would shoot me things like, hey, you know, keep doing what you're doing, or just little things here and there. But she was holding to her guns. And as time kind of went on, and I finally had moved to that point of, okay, I got to do this for me. You know, she was my last piece that I was doing it for. And I finally said, I got to do this for me. And that's really when I started doing some more internal work. And, you know, things kind of went on, and we started talking a little bit and tried the dating thing, you know, let's go to dinner and let's do some things. And I mean, 'cause we had been together for like 4 years before that. This, you know, like it was, we had a relationship, and I cared for her. She still cared for me. She just didn't like the person I was. I did stupid stuff.
And can you blame her?
Yeah, no, man. I was a jerk. Like, I mean, I remember after all this happened, she called me and was like, hey, you know, I just found that there's a credit card that's ran up. And of course, what I say, I don't know what that is, right? I mean, there was all these little things that honestly I had forgotten that just kept getting, you know, eroded. And so anyway, so we kind of started dating. And I was in a good spot. Things were good, you know, and we weren't like right back together or anything. But one night she handed me an envelope, and it was those papers. She had never actually filed them. Everyone thought she had, including me, family, everybody. And she had just said she just didn't feel right about it yet. You know, she wanted to make sure she was making the right decision. And every single day to this day, man, I'm thankful she didn't. And I'm grateful for the reason that it got me to that point, you know, because if I would have somehow weaseled my way back in or whatever happened, I don't think I'd be sitting here, you know, like I'd probably be one of, you know, the clients at Wasatch right now. I, I needed that. I needed someone to hold my feet to the fire. My parents couldn't do it. The law couldn't do it. You know, I needed that person to do it. And
turns out she was your person.
She is, and she still is, man. We have two beautiful kids. You know, we're still married. Every time our anniversary comes along, I always joke, minus a year and a half, you know.
But. The asterisk year.
Yeah, the
asterisk year. Well, what's great about that is that's a really, really good example of how important holding those boundaries are. Absolutely. If you happen to be the loved one of somebody in active addiction right now, and I think that if she were here, she'd probably talk about how hard that was for her, how heartbreaking it was to not talk to you, to hold that boundary tight, to get the divorce papers to you, to, you know, to have you sign. I'm sure that was really an emotional, difficult thing for her, but how absolutely vital those boundaries are in helping somebody find their way back to recovery.
So. Yeah. Well, and it, you know, back to when you guys were speaking earlier about opinions, you know, it's the same thing. Like, I had opinions about myself, you know, she was getting opinions here, all these opinions. And what it boiled down to is we need to go off of what we believe and what's good for us. Sometimes we don't know what that is. Right. I mean, that we learned that. If she was here, you would ask her. In the midst of it, she didn't know what she was doing. You know, luckily she had some inclination to say, "Hey, I gotta do this." You know,
well, she's following her intuition, and let's be honest, the ladies are better at that than we are.
She is, and that's definitely her talent. You know, and it's funny because if you ask her to this day, she's like, "I didn't know. I just was going off my gut."
Yeah,
and luckily that is what saved me. And that's why I'm here now. You know, I mean, after all that, you know, I decided I wanted to go back to school and I wanted to work in this field. And I went back and became a counselor and I've worked now in this field for like 15 years, which is freaking crazy. And I've, you know, been a director of a few different places and ran places. I opened a place with some people at New Roads Treatment Center. We opened a place in Florida all the way across the country. I mean, I've done a lot of cool things, and I could have never done any of that without where I've been, you know. And it's weird because, like, even this, like, back to when you were talking about opinions, you know, I mean, this goes out to a million people, right? I mean, all these people will hear it and all these things, and we've done this a thousand times. People know who we are. But yeah, I mean, people have opinions, you know, and they think, oh my gosh, you know, they've done this or they've done that. We've seen some pretty bad things. We've done some pretty bad things.
But on the flip side of that coin, you've seen some really wonderful things.
And that's what I was going to say.
And that's what keeps us going.
Right. And the opinions of other people, you know, it's just opinions, you know. I mean, I'll be honest with you, man. When you went through your stuff, I didn't know who you were, right? And I saw the comments online and I saw this. And you don't even know this, but I reached out. I sent DMs to you, to KSL. I'm like, we got to help this guy. Because I didn't know you, but I knew the situation. You know, and one, being there, and then two, knowing the situation, I'm like, we got to help this guy. Someone's got to reach out to this dude, you know, and we do that all the time. It's crazy. The people that we've kind of reached out to and helped, and it hit me when you're talking about opinions, because yeah. I had an opinion. All these people have these opinions, but I know the situation. I didn't know you. I just needed to help you.
So my therapist, you know, we sat down and we pulled up the Facebook page with my mugshot. And he wanted me to read all the comments. I've said about this on the podcast before. And I was like, I don't want to. And he goes, why? And I go, because they are going to just roast me. And they're going to beat me up. And he said, hey, those are opinions. He goes, but you might be surprised. And I sat down and we did a whole session of us just reading comments and kind of dissecting them. Cool. And for the most part, people were really, really nice and supportive, saying, I hope he gets the help he needs. And I hope this. And there was a handful, 15%, that were like, this guy sucks.
Always.
You know, couldn't have happened to a nicer guy, you know, that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Which yeah. There's going to be haters out there, and that's okay. But what I loved about it was, and what I learned, is that most people do want you to get help. And they want to be there. And I think, you know, you all three of us, before we found out about recovery, didn't know recovery was the thing. And we were all seasoned veteran partiers. You know what I mean? And you never knew that recovery was possible. So that's what I want to know. What makes Wasatch Recovery different? What are you guys doing there that seems to be working?
Wasatch is a special place. You know, Ryan can attest to it. He's been through there. I've worked at several different places. And there is a, I always joke about it, kind of a mystique or a spirit about Wasatch. And we even have like a little saying up there called the Wasatch Way, you know, what we do there. And I'll tell you, it's a tough program. You know, it's not easy. I mean, you're not just going there, getting massages and hanging out. It's pretty intense. We are, our heaviest focus is on processing. You know, people get there and they're like, okay, do I get my AA book and my, you know, my worksheets and this and that? And
what time's the gym and dinner?
Yeah. I mean, that's just not the way we roll. I mean, there's a girl there right now that I was talking to, her and her mom. She's been there about a week or so, and she was telling her mom, you know, what they do. And I'm kind of just sitting back as she's telling mom. And in my head, I'm thinking, mom probably thinks this is pretty rough. Because she's like, yeah, we have group in the morning for 3 hours, and then we do this, and then we have group. And it's pretty intense. And when we walk into groups, we sometimes go into the groups without a topic. You know, we're not going in there like, okay, hey guys, we're going to talk about addiction in the brain today. It might lead to that, but we just sit down in a circle and say, hey, what's going on in the house? And, you know, we let someone bring something up, and it just turns into a 3-hour process group. And our therapists are incredible. I mean, we have all master's level therapists that lead all the groups. They all have their own little niches of what they do, but it's pretty intense. I mean, he knows. I mean, there was times where I'd walk past the door when he was in treatment, and I'm like, is this guy going to kill somebody? Cause he's flipping out and just, but it's in a controlled environment. I mean, I don't want you to think that it's like,
but there is some stuff that has to get loud and have to
process. Groups are a good process group. Is like the detox, but it's for your emotions and for your traumas in life. And if you think about how tough it is going to detox for a week and all of that junk is getting out of your body, it's the same thing. A good process group should be exhausting when you're done. And I'm glad to hear you guys make that a priority there.
So, Decker, you went through the program. What makes Wasatch different?
Well, just talk about what Corey was talking about. Like, yeah, I do remember that time. And like the process is, that's hard. Like and especially if you're just trying to fake it. Like, it's pretty hard to hear some of the stuff. And finally, kind of a light bulb for me is that my therapist says, you got to admit you love drugs more than your kids. And I remember processing, I'm going to hit this guy as hard as I can. I'll probably do a night in jail. I'll get bailed out. Probably worth it.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, like an idiot, I just stormed out of the group. And then I thought about it. I'm like, how crazy is that, that something in my life came before what I love most? And that was tough, but it was also a turning point. Somebody had to say it. Hearing it come out of somebody else's mouth is tough to hear. And so what Corey means by tough is it is tough. We don't coddle. This ain't a bed and breakfast, right? We've only got, you know, insurance is limited on what they're willing to help with, right, time frame wise. And so we get after it. And it's uncomfortable, but –
necessary.
Yeah. I mean, getting uncomfortable, you know, getting comfortable being uncomfortable, right? And then you start to grow. And it is crazy. I went in a week before Christmas, leaving 3 kids behind. Never had a roommate in my life, right? And I was like, I'm willing to do whatever, you know, to try to get this family back. But in reality, the only way I could have done it is if it is what it is. It was like a family away from my family, right? That homesick, that blackout period where you can't talk to anybody for, you know, weeks on end or whatever it was back then. But it was tough. But you know what? They seriously loved me until I could love myself, you know, which a lot of people say, but it was true, right? I was this broken person at my all-time lowest. You know, I mean, I got to a point I had to go to rehab, right? I only thought that was on TV. But it really is. And there is a certain feeling there that you're in the safest place you're ever going to be. You've got a whole bunch of people whose lives depend on this working. And when you get in a safe place like that, it makes it easier to surrender, right? And surrender is a tough one for me. I don't want to go there. Like, why do they need to know about that? It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. In reality, it did. I stuffed that down for decades and decades. And it, you know, it hurt. You know what I mean? It took me on this path of destruction. And when I finally talked about it, I could start working through it and processing. A lot of things about this process group is even when other people are processing stuff, you're like thinking, oh, Oh, yeah, I did that. Yeah, check, check, check. So you don't even necessarily have to be the one processing.
Oh, yeah.
Right, but you're, like, constantly learning. But the end game at Wasatch is happiness, right? We don't talk about the drugs and alcohol. Like, that's besides the point. Let's figure out why we did it in the first place. Let's work on the trauma stuff. But the end game is 100% happiness. And for me, you know, how I did it is, you know, I did 90 days in treatment. Afterwards, I lived in Utah County, so I wasn't going to drive up here. And I did a horrible place in Utah County that's no longer there. But it gave me accountability, right? Drug mm-hmm. tests, right? A place I could still go dump out all the stuff on how crappy my day was. And, hey, I thought I'd go to treatment, everything would be hunky-dory. And, you know, which it wasn't. But it was awesome because I play sober softball on Friday nights. What else was I doing on a Friday night? I would play in a sober golf league. It's called Good Time Golf, the greatest thing ever.
Oh, I know about it. Yeah.
And seriously, and I started to realize that, like, all these friends and people that weren't beneficial for me being the best version of myself had to go. And it's hard because some of those are lifelong friends. But what I did gain is a whole group of, like, amazing friends that did just that and made me a better person. And it ended up being the Wasatch staff. And we would do all these things together. I'm like, holy crap, these guys are having fun golfing without drinking.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah. Wait, we can go skiing and not get trashed?
That's a thing too.
Yeah, I'm like, what? Like Vegas? Are you kidding me? No cocktails, just Red Bulls?
I'm still not so sure about the sober softball, but. Yeah.
but seriously, so Mark and Jeff, the owners at Wasatch, have done a really good job of building programs to kind of build a community of support. Which is awesome. I mean, it's freaking awesome.
Well, I love that you guys both stopped by today to share your story of recovery and how wonderful it can be and that it is possible. It's Corey and
Ryan Decker.
We just call him Decker.
Oh, Decker. Okay.
Yeah. I was testing you to see if you were in on this.
If I was in on it. Well, I think of him sort of like a prince
yeah.
or a Madonna, just like the one name. You know?
Decker.
Decker.
Yeah. So your thoughts on today?
Well, what I love about, I mean, thank you both, obviously, for sharing your stories. I really like the fact that you're just average guys who went on to have big addictions because I want everybody to hear that. It's not a respecter of persons. Anybody can become addicted no matter how you grow up. There's a lot of different things in your stories I could comment on. All I want to comment on is I love the fact that Wasatch is a place like many other, I wouldn't say many other, I shouldn't say that. The better recovery centers today are places that create a community. And it's a place people want to go back to. And it's a place where they feel like I can be my best self in and around these people. And so it kind of goes back to maybe what your dad or your grandma told you. It's like, you know, who you hang around with, that's going to have an influence on who you become. And that's not just for when you're 10 years old. That's at any age. And so I love the fact that people can go to Wasatch, they can get the real treatment that they need, and then they can feel like for the rest of their lives they have a community of people that help elevate them as you elevate other people. And I think both of you mentioned in your own way, you love that opportunity to help others, and that's what it's all about.
I forget which rich dude it is, but he says, hey, you want to show me how successful you're going to be in life? Show me your friends.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I think the opposite of addiction is what? Connection. Dr. Matt. Come on,
my
man.
My connections are firing slow.
We should be finishing each other's
sandwiches.
Yes. Yeah. But thank you for stopping by Project Recovery. If people want more information about Wasatch Recovery, where do they go, guys?
You can go online at wasatchrecovery.com, and it's got all the information on there and my phone number.
All right. What's your phone number?
801-318-4240.
And just ask for him.
Yep.
Decker.
Just say just one word.
Decker.
Yeah.
Maybe they could team up with that one guy, one call, that's all.
Yeah.
Decker.
One Decker, that's all.
That's all you need.
Huh. You don't need two Deckers because he's got a lot of energy.
I don't think we can handle two Deckers.
Yeah. Just one Decker for me.
Yeah. But that double Decker does have a nice ring to it, right?
Yeah. I think, okay, let's go back to the marketing table. We got to talk to Wasatch.
Thank you for stopping by and listening to the podcast today. Project Recovery is a KSL podcast. We love you and we mean it.
The contents of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.